The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 4, 2023. It is, as usual, bordered in the front cover in red with a narrow white inner border. Our 100th year is still that thumbprint turning page area up in the right-hand corner, and Time is in large capital block lettering in white upon a blue background. The roller coaster is apparent on the front cover. It has multi-levels in it, but this one is going downhill with Donald Trump in the front seat, which is decorated in red, white, and blue motif. Yet these are apparently Photoshopped illustrations because I see faces that look real, but perhaps none of the rest is of an actual photograph. Donald Trump is wearing a dark blue suit, white shirt, and red tie. His blondish hair is flying in the wind, and he has his fists raised, and he's yelling at something. About two cars behind him seats Governor DeSantis, also dressed in shades of blue, but no tie there. Behind him, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 others in 1, 2, 3, 4 different roller coaster cars. Mr. Mike Pence is obvious among them, as is Mr. Chris Christie, and I'm unable to identify the remainder. Does this ride ever end? Inside the GOP Race by Molly Ball, which is what I'm going to read to you. Photograph is by Demetrius Freeman. Now, this photograph is actually of former President Donald Trump. Again, wearing the blue suit, white shirt, no tie, but he has a big flag on his left lapel. Blondish hair, smiling at a crowd. He's surrounded by a crowd of either onlookers or journalists. I do see a couple of fancy high-tech cameras there in the group surrounding him. Politics, deja vu. It's getting late early in the GOP primary as the front runner's rivals struggle with the campaign's central question, how do you stop Trump? And the caption of this photograph reads, by the way, the background is very dark with just a few blurry lights as if on a Christmas tree. The caption reads, the former president at the Iowa State Fair in Des Moines, August 12. Molly Ball writes this from Albia, Iowa, with reporting by Julia Zorthian, New York. This is a lengthy article. I may abridge it, but beginning here, the Iowa voter had a question for Ron DeSantis, a plea of sorts on behalf of all the small-town people. Outsiders suggest we're the flyover country, the racists, the deplorables, the Walmart shoppers. Jason Summers, a 53-year-old Republican activist who owns a small insurance business, tells the governor of Florida. Presidential candidates, he adds, come around every 4 years. They kiss our babies, pat us on the head, and send us on our way. Then they forget about us. How could the residents of Albia, Iowa, population 3,712, be sure DeSantis would not abandon them, too? Less than an hour earlier, DeSantis had roared into town juggernaut style, disembarking from a bus emblazoned with his name and that of Never Back Down, his $100 million super PAC, trailed by a dozen advisors and security staff. DeSantis has vowed to visit all of Iowa's 99 counties, albeit Monroe County would be number 31. Precisely for moments like this one, a chance to commune with voters and perhaps even have the sort of viral moment that would loft his struggling campaign back into contention for the GOP presidential nomination. Now he stood in a former church converted to a veterans wellness center, surrounded by a scrum of media, cameras, and microphones extended to watch him take a swing at the softball Summers lobbed up. But given the chance to offer some hint of emotion, DeSantis proceeds to answer the question like a standardized test. First, he says, the stereotypes about flyover country are not a narrative that I've ever accepted. And then he points out that while people may associate his state with places like Miami or Palm Beach or Central Florida theme parks, it also has a lot of those types of communities. They're important, DeSantis adds, in part because they produce many recruits for the military and law enforcement. But I do think the clash of kind of elites on the coast is these guys have really strong values here, and they don't always like that, he concludes, without a flicker of passion. This is the man who was supposed to be the Trump slayer. Yet as the 2024 campaign lumbers into gear, DeSantis has never looked like less of a threat to the former president's chances of returning to office. Bloodied by a barrage of typically nasty Trump insults and millions in negative ads from Trump's allies, his campaign has been a litany of disappointment, declining steadily in the polls since its botched Twitter launch, May 24. His culture war message is not moving voters. Donors fret. He's not ready for prime time. Pundits pick apart his every stilted move. The campaign has recently undergone an extended reboot, laying off dozens of staff and replacing the campaign manager. Many of the same conservatives who once crowned him the future of the GOP are already declaring him toast. The front-runner, meanwhile, has put forth the minimum imaginable effort, sleepwalking through rote speeches, jeering at federal law enforcement, visiting Iowa only a handful of times. He has skipped campaign cattle calls, insulted the state's popular Republican governor, danced around the abortion issue that animates many of the religious conservatives who make up the backbone of the GOP base. Just before the first Republican presidential debate, August 23 in Milwaukee, he had not yet decided whether to bother showing up. And why should he? He's running away with this thing as rivals flounder and leap to his defense after each successive criminal indictment. Rather than condemn the actions that have now led to 91 state and federal charges, DeSantis, like most of the field, has bolstered Trump's claims of victimization, decrying the supposed weaponization of government and vowing to pardon the former president if he's convicted. I think the Department of Justice is highly political. I think the charges in D.C. are flimsy charges, DeSantis tells me in an interview days before a Florida grand jury hands down yet another Trump indictment for crimes against democracy. Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucuses, January 15, loom as the best chance to change the race's frozen trajectory. The state has a history of elevating long-shot, close-touch candidates, particularly those who win the hearts of religious conservatives. Many of these voters have continuing qualms about Trump, whose lead over DeSantis is slightly smaller here than nationally. In polls, some 70% of potential caucus goers say they're open to a non-Trump candidate. Yet DeSantis has failed to make it the two-man race many anticipated. And no one in the rest of the field, a well-credentialed group that includes current and former governors, a sitting senator, and Trump's own vice president, has risen to take his place as Trump's chief rival. So the candidates have descended on Iowa, blitzing the airwaves with commercials, patronizing small businesses, giving speeches to local groups. The state's Republican voters see America at a tipping point and want above all to find a candidate who can win the general election. The longtime Iowa GOP chairman, Jeff Kaufman, tells me they want to see the candidates up close and personal, to look them in the eye and hear it straight. On his recent swings through the state, DeSantis has held town halls and meet and greets, popped into small town coffee houses, traipsed through sweaty fairgrounds. "We've got to run the long race, not the short race," DeSantis's newly installed campaign manager, James Utmeyer, tells me. "It is back to basics. Follow your gut. Listen to the voters. Trump is not what is in the eyesight. It is the voters, the Iowans, the people that are struggling." DeSantis, like everyone else, wants to believe the campaign is about something else. The issues, the current president, the price of tea in China, when it is self-evidently about one thing only, the singular binary question that has perplexed the political system for so many years. Can Trump be stopped? In Albia, DeSantis takes a few more questions from locals and the media before being hustled back onto his campaign bus, where he will head to the next flyover town, hit all his marks, make the intended contacts, tick another county off the list. As the bus pulls out, I return to Jason Summers, who's chatting with the town's mayor on the steps of the former church. I bring up his poignant remark about politicians kissing babies and then forgetting about their promises. Did he feel Trump had done that? Summers thinks about the question. "Honestly, I think just the opposite," he says. "One of the strange things about President Trump was that while he did not have that small-town politeness, he identified with the small-town issues. That hardness that Trump speaks with, they looked over because he was actually fighting for them." At a town hall in the Des Moines suburb of Ankeny, a man gets up to ask Tim Scott a question. Reading from a notebook, Steve Alexander, a ponytailed local in a beret and vest, informs the senator he has a five-pronged test for candidates that he calls the five P's. That's P as in Peter. On the first three, personality, politics, performance, Scott has passed with flying colors. "It boils down to the last two things, promises and policies," Alexander continues. "One thing about Trump, he made promises and he kept them where it was possible." Scott, the only black Republican in the Senate and a devout Christian, has been rising modestly in the Iowa polls as DeSantis slips. His campaign and affiliated super PAC have blanketed the state with ads touting his sunny aspirational appeal. A conventional rank-and-file Republican, he helped design Trump's 2017 tax cut bill and voted against both his impeachments, but did not object to certifying the 2020 election. Scott centers his campaign message on the idea that his life story puts the lie to liberal accusations of a racist society. "Where do I start?" he asks Alexander, grinning. Scott talks about his record and outlines a set of proposals he would pursue on issues like taxes, school choice, and opportunity zones. He speaks with feeling about his upbringing, sprinkling in religious references and folksy sayings. At one point, he describes Biden's spending policies as like a goose lost in a rainstorm. A capacity crowd has packed the airy venue, and Scott's easy banter with Governor Kim Reynolds has them laughing along. Afterward, he takes questions from reporters, including one about a controversy DeSantis faces back home over proposed Florida educational standards that say enslaved people sometimes benefited from skills they learned in bondage. Scott manages to attack the substance while seeming magnanimous at the same time. What slavery was really about was separating families, about mutilating humans, even raping their wives. It was just devastating. I would hope every person in our country, and certainly running for president, would appreciate that. But he adds, people have bad days. Sometimes they regret what they say. Anti-Trump Republicans point to precedent to make the case Iowans will slow his momentum. In the 2016 election, Trump cannonballed into the state ignoring all the rules. He named a former apprentice contestant as state campaign co-chair, brought a helicopter to the Iowa State Fair, did little of the usual retail politicking. Most experts assumed the thrice-married former Democrat would not appeal to a state partial to humble, church-going candidates like the previous two caucus winners, former Governor Mike Huckabee and former Senator Rick Santorum. Senator Ted Cruz courted conservative voters with a data-fueled grassroots organization, while Senator Marco Rubio appealed to business-minded moderates, a typical GOP base establishment split. In several days, attending events across the state for numerous candidates, I met many of the voters AFP and other anti-Trump groups are targeting. They voted for Trump against Biden and Hillary Clinton with varying degrees of enthusiasm, but now they're weary of the drama and ready for a fresher face. They like what they hear from DeSantis, Scott, and others, and they feel they have plenty of time to make up their minds over the next 5 months. Talking to these earnest, enthusiastic Republicans, the race can indeed feel wide open. But when I ask them who they caucused for in 2016, these voters invariably say Cruz or Rubio, not Trump. For those trying to topple the front runner, the problem is not the voters who are coming out to see them. It is the voters who are not. The Lincoln Dinner is the Iowa GOP's big fundraising event, and on a Friday night in late July, more than 1,200 Republicans take their seats at tables laid with chicken and cheesecake in the Des Moines Convention Center. An event like this is a chance for an underdog to make a splash. The 13 candidates on the program range from Trump and DeSantis to businessman Perry Johnson and pastor Ryan Binkley. The long-shot candidates would need a figurative lightning strike to put them into the contention. Yet still, they won't risk the ire of the pro-Trump crowd. Only former GOP Congressman Will Hurd dares rock the boat. Donald Trump is not running for president to make America great again or represent the people that voted for him, he says. Donald Trump is running to stay out of prison. Hurd is promptly booed off the stage. Inside the convention center, a man strums a guitar in Nikki Haley's suite, while in DeSantis's, people are invited to chuck baseballs at pyramids of Bud Light cans, an allusion to a recent culture war controversy. But the only suite with a line out the door is the one where Trump stands behind a black clothed barrier, posing for thumbs-up pictures with fans. Annette Hoover, a 75-year-old retired saleswoman from Indianola, tells me she is Trump all the way and has been since the beginning. I can see what's been going on is affecting him, she says, looking genuinely pained. It is awful what they have been doing to him. Hoover enjoyed listening to all the candidates, but only one of them to her is a president. He's an a-hole, to be honest, but that's what it takes to deal with the people he deals with, she says. We have got to get him back. We are in a world of hurt right now. DeSantis, she says, might make a good VP. That article by Molly Ball was slightly abridged. From The View, captioned health, The Parent Trap by Jenny Anderson. Anderson is a journalist and podcaster currently working on a book about the science of motivating teens. American teens are having a hard time. High school students reporting chronic feelings of sadness and hopelessness rose from 1 in 5 to 1 in 3 from 2008 to 2019, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. By the pandemic fall of 2021, the feelings were reported by 42% of high school students and almost 60% of girls. The thing is, a lot of parents are in really bad shape, too. The attention to the kids makes sense. The CDC's 2021 data showed a quarter of teen girls had made a suicide plan. Social media has been blamed for the rise in mood disorders, as have sleep deprivation, spikes in loneliness, and academic pressure. One of the key ways we can bolster teens' mental health and buffer the vulnerable is healthy, attuned relationships with their parents. The trouble is that can be problematic too. According to two national surveys completed as the pandemic wound down in December 2022, about 20% of mothers and 15% of fathers reported anxiety, compared with 18% of teens. About 15% of teens reported depression, alongside 16% of mothers and 10% of fathers. In total, about one-third of teens had a parent suffering from reported anxiety or depression. Our data suggests we would be just as right to sound the alarm about the state of parents' mental health as about teens' mental health, writes Richard Weisbord, director of the Making Caring Common Project at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. One of the authors of Caring for the Caregivers, The Critical Link Between Parent and Teen Mental Health. Depressed and anxious adults who are parents of teens are faced with the double whammy of trying to manage themselves while simultaneously supporting teens. For adolescents, worrying about a parent or caregiver can be destabilizing when life seems rocky enough. Weisbord's data show depressed teens are about 5 times as likely as non-depressed teens to have a depressed parent, and that anxious teens are about 3 times as likely as non-anxious teens to have an anxious parent. About 40% of those surveyed were at least somewhat worried about a parent's mental health. The bottom line, if we want to help teens, we need to help their parents too. Depressed and anxious parents can be excellent caregivers. Their own experience can build empathy and give adults language they can use to help teens navigate similar emotional terrain. But research shows children of parents with untreated depression have higher rates of behavior problems, difficulty coping with stress and forming healthy relationships, academic problems, and mental illness. If both parents and child are suffering, the two can set each other off, with adults lacking the energy required to focus on their child's struggles. Anxious and depressed teens will show frustration, lashing out at caregivers. Being attuned to kids' emotional states is a crucial way parents support healthy development. When infants cry and parents attend to them, important stress regulation skills are built. When a child babbles and a parent reacts gleefully, the child learns to keep talking and exploring. Child development specialists call it serve and return. The baby serves up a sound or venture, and the parent returns affection and love, building a bond of trust and helping the infant self-regulate. The ways we stay connected to our children change as they grow and mature, but the principle remains the same. A child's sense of self grows stronger and matures by being known, attended to, and by feeling they matter, first and foremost to their parents or caregivers, though the influence of peers clearly grows as they age. The human relationship has the power to relieve stress, promote resilience, restore a young person's sense of safety, says Pamela Cantor, a child and adolescent psychiatrist who specializes in trauma. Stress releases cortisol to the body and brain, which causes the feelings of fight, flight, or freeze. Having an adult who loves you unconditionally can buffer that. Relationships that are strong and trustful release the hormone oxytocin, and oxytocin can restore a child's sense of safety, Cantor explains. But for a parent who is depressed or anxious, it can be hard to connect with anyone, much less teens who are Jedi masters at pushing parents' buttons. Providing the emotional support teens need becomes harder. Depression has two main classes of causes, says Dr. William Beardsley, chairman emeritus of children's psychology at Boston, that's children's psychiatry at Boston Children's Hospital. One probably involves genetic vulnerability. Families with a lot of history of depression tend to have more depression. The second is psychosocial adversity. Negative life experiences such as poverty or the effects of violence and racism. The single, probably largest risk factor for depression, Beardsley says, is having a parent die when you're a child. One of his key takeaways from a longitudinal study of families with diagnosable mental illness was that the children of parents with mood disorders have higher rates of mood disorders themselves. Another takeaway was even in that situation, many of the kids were resilient and doing well. Beardsley pioneered an intervention called family talk. In families with depression, the depression shut down the capacity to have conversations and problem solve together, he explains. The program involves talking to each party separately, parent and child, and then helping the adult plan a conversation about what depression is, who is getting treatment, how they're going to overcome it, and then actually having the conversation in a family meeting led by the parents and assisted by the clinician. We found that explaining what was happening and saying the kids can be normal and happy despite depression and the parents can be very good parents despite depression was very helpful, Beardsley said. Actively being part of the conversation is also powerful for a depressed parent. Weisbord's report, which cites Beardsley's work, also emphasizes communication. The key, it says, is ensuring teens know adults lashing out or withdrawing love is due to the illness and not the child. It can make a big difference if a parent simply tells a teen, "I am struggling with some things right now. If I seem shut down or irritable, it is not your fault." The report offers other insights for parents, depressed or not. When teens were asked what they needed from adults, the number one answer, 40% of respondents chose it was for their parents to reach out more to ask how they're really doing and to really listen. As one teen said, "Don't only look at me through the keyhole, open the door." Adults also need to recognize teens are feeling lost. If this sounds trite, it is not. Of teens surveyed, 36% reported little or no purpose or meaning in life, and this absence strongly correlated with depression and anxiety. Adolescence is a period of massive brain reconstruction and identity formation. A key way that identity is formed is through meaning, finding ways to matter in the world. The tsunami of focus on wellness places too much attention on how to make ourselves happy and not enough on how helping others actually makes us happy, which study after study shows makes humans happier. In the media and public life, beauty and perfection sell, not altruism and kindness. That leaves it to us, the caregivers, to help teens find meaning or at least hope. Cantor cites research from Anna Freud, who studied the effects of World War II on children. Why did children who stayed with their mothers, enduring years of bombing in the Blitz, fare better than those kids who were evacuated? Somehow, in the middle of the Blitz and London being bombed, a mother would say to a kid, "We're going to make it through this." Did they know that? Did they have a crystal ball? No. But they knew that what they needed to do in that moment was to shore up the child's beliefs that this was solvable, Cantor says. The kids sent away didn't have that parental assurance. Humans heal, she emphasizes, mentally and physically. They solve things. The human experience is about solving things. Here is a short article from The View inbox, "Climate is Everything," by Aaron, A-R-Y-N, Baker, senior correspondent. There's a small photo here. It's in color, a bright turquoise blue sky with clouds smudging it. In the foreground is a person. We see only the bottom half of the person wearing tan pants, tan shoes, and a bunch of tools suspended probably from a belt at the waist. But the rest of the person's obliterated by a piece of plywood that's being carried. Construction workers toil in the heat on a new subdivision being built in Loganville, Georgia, in July. Rooftops of new homes are already apparent over a small hillside. One of the enduring legacies of this summer's heat waves is a disease that few people have heard of. First documented in El Salvador sugarcane workers 21 years ago, chronic kidney disease of non-traditional origin, CKDNT, occurs among manual laborers working in high heat conditions. Characterized by a progressive loss of kidney function, CKDNT has already killed tens of thousands. As temperatures increase because of climate change, those numbers will rise, contributing to what is arguably the world's first occupational disease caused by global warming. Like other workplace injuries, CKDNT can be prevented with increased safety standards. Epidemiologist Jason Glazer has no doubt that CKDNT is already present in the U.S. Absolutely everywhere we've looked that has Venn diagram of heavy work and high heat with poor labor protections, lo and behold, there it is. But in a dangerous oversight, public health tracking of the disease in the U.S. is limited, says Glazer, head of the CKDNT advocacy organization, La Isla Network. It is so easy to prevent, he says. Yet with dialysis or kidney donation, your only options, so expensive to treat. While the causes are still debated, it appears to be triggered by heat-related kidney injuries like heat stroke and is exacerbated by continued exposure and dehydration. Approximately 8% to 10% of workers with acute kidney injury, AKI, from heat will go on to develop CKDNT within 12 months, says Glazer. This is the black lung disease of today's outdoor laborers, and climate change is making it worse. And here's another shorter article, Health Matters, by Jamie Ducharme, health correspondent. I don't know about you, but I have ingrained in my brain the idea that taking 10,000 steps per day is the mark of an active lifestyle, which means it's often pretty depressing to check the step tracker on my phone after an average day of writing while seated at my desk. At least it was depressing until I read the conclusion of a recent research review published in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology. The doctors found that taking just 4,000 steps per day, the equivalent of walking around 2 miles, is enough to significantly reduce your risk of premature death. And walking as few as 2,500 steps per day may meaningfully reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease-specific causes of death. That is based on their analysis of 17 previously published studies on walking and health, which cumulatively included more than 225,000 adults from multiple countries who were tracked for an average of 7 years. The findings are no reason to shorten your daily stroll. Walking more is better, the researchers found. They concluded that each additional 1,000 steps per day is linked to a roughly 15% lower risk of dying early from any cause, and they did not find evidence of a point at which additional activity stops being beneficial. So if you're already logging 10,000 steps a day, there's no need to stop. But if, like me, you often fall short of that benchmark, you can take comfort in the fact that even relatively small amounts of movement seem to measurably benefit health and longevity. That may sound too good to be true for 10,000-step devotees, but a number of recent studies and the U.S. federal physical activity guidelines have reached similar conclusions. Some research has shown mild forms of movement not typically considered exercise, like housework, can have a meaningful impact on overall well-being, while other studies have argued that there are real benefits to getting even a few minutes of physical activity each day. Exercise, it seems, is a powerful tool for improving health, even in encouragingly small doses. Here is the View essay under the caption, Music, The Day Hip-Hop Changed Forever, by Amir Questlove Thompson, who is a musician, author, and filmmaker. Well, there's a photo here. It's in color, but it's really a collage of four different images of four different men of color. From left, rappers, Snoop Dogg, whom I recognize because of TV commercials, Biggie, B-I-G-G-I-E, and he is a substantially large-sized individual, Nas, N-A-S, with two fingers up, and Dr. Dre, D-R-E. As a person who loves history, I am one of those people who can spot a historical moment as it's happening, both as a participant and as an outside viewer. So, to be 2 years older than what we consider to be the birth of hip-hop, and to grow up with it like a sibling, it's a fortunate feeling because I got to witness a lot of firsts. Sometimes this shifting of paradigms was to the benefit of hip-hop, and sometimes, unfortunately, to its detriment. But nothing could have prepared me for the moment when hip-hop, as I knew it, changed forever. The 1995 Source Awards. The 95 Source Awards was a funeral in hip-hop's history, and I don't say that in hindsight. I knew it, walking into the Paramount Theater in New York City, August 3, 1995, and I knew it, running away. And when I say running, I am not exaggerating. I was running for my life. It felt like the creative version of Apocalypse Now. In 1992, Dr. Dre released The Chronic, and what made that album notable was that it signaled the first push toward the rock star lifestyle in hip-hop. While not blatantly representing opulence, The Chronic was the blueprint that Sean Diddy Combs listened to and made the new standard. In the people's eyes, it was the first album by a credible producer and MC that didn't have to pander to a safe We Come in Peace formula that your grandma was singing to. The album put big numbers on the board and dominated MTV. And once New York saw that this was the golden ticket, suddenly everyone fell in line. Art was one thing, but survival became more important and by any means necessary. That was the mentality with which everyone was walking into the Paramount Theater in 95. The first person I noticed was Nas, who was making his way to a seat four rows ahead of me. The big question of the night was who was going to win Rap Album of the Year, Illmatic by Nas or Ready to Die by the notorious B.I.G., a.k.a. Biggie. Having received a rare 5-mic rating from the source for Illmatic, Nas was the gold standard. It seemed like it could have been his night. But the momentum that Biggie had since his album came out was undeniable. As he began to sweep one award after the next, Nas sank lower and lower into his seat. By the end of the night, I knew Nas was going to throw away everything and do it, compete with Biggie. The result of that night was in part the release of his second album, It Was Written. And while it was Nas's most successful record, it came at a cost. Nas was open for business, adjusting his music so people who embraced The Chronic and Ready to Die would also embrace him. Literally one by one, everyone realized they had to compromise. And I don't mean compromise as a four-letter word, because nothing comes before your survival when you are a black person. Because, yes, even your art might have to be sacrificed. That realization and the hopelessness that followed was why the Source Awards was one of the most depressing days of my life. I didn't know if I had a future. By the time they handed Dr. Dre the award for Producer of the Year, the energy became reminiscent of an old-fashioned Western barroom brawl. All I remember was I grabbed my date and we ran for our lives. The second we heard Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, I thought, we're all going to die. And in a slow sort of way, I was right. The hip-hop that I loved was gone. And that night an hourglass turned over. But as I was running, a guy in the street came up to me and said, "Yo, take this." He put the cassette in my hands, and it said D'Angelo, Brown Sugar. Normally, I never took demos. But I don't think it's a coincidence that on that day that I thought the culture was ending, I would meet the very person I would wind up creating Voodoo with, another paradigm-shifting masterpiece, A Rebirth. Written by Amir Questlove Thompson, as told to Rachel Sonas. This is the 8 questions page by Olivia B. Waxman. Let's see if there really are 8. It's the question and answer format. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yep. The person who is featured today is Jill Lepore, L-E-P-O-R-E. She's pictured here in a black and white photograph. She has kind of straight and ruffled up looking blonde hair. She's wearing dark rimmed with lighter accents glasses, and she's wearing a dark outfit. The top, well, we see only the top of her, so it's a dark turtleneck with a cardigan over it. She's smiling at the camera. The Harvard historian on her new book of essays, The Deadline, The Catastrophe of Social Networks, and Why She Hated Barbie. This is question and answer. Was there a moment growing up that inspired you to become a historian? Answer. I had my Italian grandmother teach me how to make meatballs. I do not speak Italian, and she did not speak English. I cannot record what she knew. I am fascinated by the loss of knowledge and the obligations of historians to recover archives. Question. Some of the essays in your new anthology are quite personal. In one, you write about having to hide your motherhood duties as a scholar and about having a miscarriage. What made you decide to reveal such personal moments? answer. That essay, which is the title of the collection, I wrote on the 20th anniversary of the death of my best friend, who died while I was giving birth to my first child. My friend Jane knew how much I wanted to have a baby and had been with me through all of those early struggles, including the miscarriage. When I was pregnant, she was diagnosed with leukemia, and she made this kind of crazy pact with herself and with me that she would not die until the baby was born. It was an expression of love and also her way of taking care of me. How could I possibly erase a detail that explains the momentous decision this person I really love had made? Question. Another essay gets into the history of Barbie. Have you seen the film? Answer. I hated the film. Question. Why? Answer. To pretend a story about peddling plastic Barbie dolls for a giant international corporation is a story of feminist liberation is unbearably sad to me. It is a bizarre, creepy love letter to tyranny and capitalism. One of the essays in my collection, which is called Valley of the Dolls, is about the intellectual property battle between Mattel and the manufacturer of the Bratz dolls. Question, how will future historians describe this period we are living in? Answer, future historians will be AI, so they will write some very boring history. I am not the person who says you must wait 50 years. The last essay in this collection, which is called The American Beast, is my reading of the January 6 Insurrection Committee report. Historians have an obligation to make sense of what's going on in the present within the absolutely explicit and abundantly confessed constraint that we do not know enough right now, and we will know more later. That is why I do what I do, because I believe we have an obligation to try to make sense of the relationship between today and yesterday. Question, is there a historical figure or event you think would make a great movie? Answer, I have heard there's this really good biography of Jane Franklin, Benjamin Franklin's sister. Lepore wrote it. She gets pregnant at 15, marries the boy next door, who I believe had raped her, and what you had to do when you got pregnant was marry the rapist. She had 12 children with that guy, who ended up in a lunatic asylum. She was poor her whole life. That is what ordinary life in the 18th century is. It is not the story Benjamin Franklin tells us in his autobiography. He erased her from the story of his life because it is inconsistent with his allegory for America that he wants to make out of the story of his rags-to-riches life. Question, are you on Facebook or Twitter? Answer, no. Question, why not? Answer, back to your question about future historians, I think the social networks will be looked on as having been fairly catastrophic. Facebook's business model is to monetize loneliness. I do not want to participate in any way in that business model. If tobacco companies had some great, fun, free thing that was seemingly free but was actually selling tobacco products to children, I also would not buy that. This is from Time Off Movies by Stephanie Zakarik. It's a review. It may be abridged. Girls just want to have fun, yet this feels like work. There's always some way to reinvigorate an old genre, and anybody with the energy and imagination to do so should try. In Emma Seligman's Bottoms, gay misfits and best friends PJ, Rachel Sennett, and Josie Ayo Edebiri face their last year of high school with a typical teenage longing. They desperately want to lose their virginity before graduation. They're gawky, socially inept. The objects of their affections, unfortunately, are cheerleaders who want nothing to do with them. Lanky, blasé Brittany, Kaya Gerber, and sweet, adorable Isabel, Havana Rose Liu, who's under the thumb of the school's bullying, numbnuts football star, Jeff Nicholas Galitzine. How many times have we seen some version of that scenario, only with gawky teenage boys as the protagonists? Bottoms reverses that equation at the start and then pushes further. In a stunning and mildly amusing lapse of logic, PJ and Josie decide their best chances at getting laid lie in starting a self-defense club at school, which rapidly devolves into a teenage fight club. The young women let loose, punching one another out and getting a kick out of it. Chaos reigns, and jokes about bulimia, gray area rape, and the emptiness of empowerment slogans fly as freely as the punches. Somehow in the middle of it all, Josie actually gets a chance at romance with Isabel, who is slowly beginning to see her domineering beau is not all that. And PJ just may have a shot with Brittany, who states pretty definitively that she is straight. But who knows? There's always hope. It should all be hilarious, bloody, sweet, transgressive, fun, but it is not. Bottoms was written by Seligman and Sennett, the director and star, respectively, of the 2020 indie comedy Shiva Baby, whose unassuming brand of humiliation humor was its finest asset. Sennett played an aimless young woman who agrees to show up at a funeral observance with her parents, only to learn that the older guy she's sleeping with and her ex-girlfriend are both in attendance as well. Calamity ensues during Kaddish. Bottoms is a bigger, more ambitious picture, designed to challenge and tickle a broader audience, but it works so hard at delivering shock value that its calculation becomes wearying. Bottoms spells out its themes in all caps, pepperly lingo, women can be raunchy. That's pepperly lingo, excuse me. Women can be raunchy. Women can be horny. Women can make jokes about all the things we are not supposed to laugh about. Even in a case like this one, where excess is the point, comedy still depends on an indefinable subtlety. Bottoms, though it presents itself as a sort of sideways heir to comedies like Heather's and But I'm a Cheerleader, simply runs its jokes into the ground. Sennett and Edabiri, the duo behind Comedy Central's A.O. and Rachel Are Single from a few years back, pedal hard to drum up the laughs, and occasionally a gag lands. Their best scene may be the opener, in which they lament their lack of hotness with a world-weary resignation that somehow churns into a whirlwind of let's give it one more try energy. Edabiri in particular, she has also appeared on The Bear, has a kind of loopy charm. But one of the actors who has the least to do, maybe the funniest, Gerber's Brittany, is a leggy supermodel type, played by an actual supermodel. And there's a good sport lurking beneath her cool girl veneer. I do not talk to girls in overalls, she purrs dismissively as she gives sartorially challenged PJ the once-over. It is an example of how a comedy's silliest, most throwaway lines can often work better than the ones designed to score points. If only Bottoms had more of that throwaway casualness. We can always use comedies that turn the old conventions inside out, opening space for new faces and fresh ideas. But you cannot buck the system just by kicking its ass. Retooling the old formulas means working smarter, not just harder. As the plot's ridiculousness accelerates, culminating in a goofy bloodbath that is not nearly as bloody or goofy as it needs to be, Bottoms becomes less and less funny. And no amount of macho, sexy roughhousing can make it work. That is the entire article, the review, written by Stephanie Zakarik. There is one photo here. It's in color. It's of five individuals. They all look like female adolescents to me. In the back row, there are two young women of color and another blonde, not blondish, kind of blondish, reddish-haired woman. And then in the front are the two leads, Etaberry and Sennett, and fellow pugilistic misfits, is what the caption reads. Well, the one who is supposedly sartorially challenged is Etaberry. She has long brown hair, and she's wearing what appears, we see only the tops of these people. She's apparently wearing a gold-colored T-shirt with a medallion, a colorful medallion, with overalls and a flannel shirt. The overalls are denim blue, and the flannel-looking shirt is a brown and cream plaid. And then next to her is Sennett. She's wearing a really loose, baggy gold and blue shirt, kind of an oversized T-shirt thing. She's wearing a dark blue knit cap, and she has a white, black and white checkered shoulder bag that she's holding. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.